President Trump's convoluted statement about the U.S. taking over Gaza now calls into question the existing ceasefire deal.
That's really problematic. Who's going to be the grown-up who enforces what was agreed to?
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. On today's show, what's next for those ceasefire negotiations? And in Syria, people are thinking about justice for the former dictator who made them live in fear.
I want a fair trial for Bashar al-Assad. I don't want him to see or face the things we faced before his courts.
In Myanmar, scammers work from jungle compounds to dupe unsuspecting people out of their money.
It's often male scammers posing as women to seduce men around the world.
Officials in neighboring Thailand are now stepping in.
Plus, some hopeful news for frogs. That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here with us this Wednesday. We begin the show in Gaza, where hopes for a sustainable ceasefire have reached a critical juncture. Negotiations on phase two of the fragile ceasefire deal are effectively on hold while Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is visiting the U.S.
President Trump's comments during a press conference with Netanyahu yesterday only served to intensify the diplomatic challenge. In case you missed it, Trump suggested the U.S. should seize control of Gaza and that the Palestinian population there should be forced out of the territory altogether.
World leaders were quick to react. Arab nations, including Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, joined the Palestinian Authority in rejecting Trump's proposal.
And yet, a ceasefire in Gaza that will hold will require buy-in from those very nations, as well as from Trump and Netanyahu. For insights on where it all goes from here, we caught up today with Khaled Al-Gindi at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He told me the talks are up in the air.
The negotiations on phase two were supposed to start this week, and that has been delayed until the weekend, until Prime Minister Netanyahu is back in Israel. So there are a lot of questions with regard to whether Netanyahu is interested at all in phase two to begin with.
Phase two, this is when all the remaining hostages in Gaza are supposed to be released, and Israel is supposed to get its troops out of Gaza completely, which is pretty much the exact opposite of what President Trump floated in his press conference last night. Can you imagine a way for negotiators to somehow get both sides to the table despite what was said?
Yeah, that's the problem. When you have the two most powerful actors in this equation, the United States and Israel, who are signaling in a direction that is not favorable towards continuing the ceasefire, that's really problematic. And who's going to be the grown-up who enforces what was agreed to? It's supposed to be the United States and the other mediators, Egypt and Qatar, but if the United States has a different vision altogether for Gaza that doesn't include Palestinians to begin with, then it really is just a guessing game.
So even if there are grown-ups in the room, what would happen? Can you imagine?
You know, the outlines of what is supposed to happen have already been agreed, presumably by all sides and accepted, including by Prime Minister Netanyahu and his coalition. It's not necessarily incompatible with Trump's somewhat bizarre vision that he articulated yesterday. We could still theoretically see a phase two, but it will depend on what message the president is sending to Netanyahu, because Netanyahu, I think, is under pressure from his extremist wing of his coalition to nix the second phase altogether and resume fighting. So will Trump okay that? We don't know the answer. We don't know what was discussed privately on that very question in the meeting between the two leaders.
So as for that bizarre vision of the U.S. taking over Gaza, as you put it, there is, of course, no legal authority that permits the U.S. to assert control over Gaza. But President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu lead powerful governments, as you pointed out, and whatever happens next, I mean, they are going to be involved in shaping it. Is peace within the realm of possibility with these two leaders?
I don't think what we would call peace in terms of a resolution to all of the outstanding issues, including Israel's occupation, the status of refugees, the future of Jerusalem, Palestinian sovereignty and self-determination. I don't think those issues are currently on the table. The best we can hope for is something much less than peace, and that is an end to the horrors of the last 15 months and the beginning of something like reconstruction, rehabilitation, let's not forget that 2 million people have been subjected to massive trauma consistently for more than 460 some odd days.
Mm. Phase two, as we mentioned, is also supposed to see the release of the remaining Israeli hostages who are alive. What potential is there for public pressure in Israel to keep the negotiations on track?
Public pressure in Israel is probably the most important factor in terms of pressuring the Netanyahu government to continue with the ceasefire. I think we cannot bank on American pressure from the Trump administration. And so if there's going to be pressure, it will come from the Israeli public, who I think overwhelmingly want to see the release of all of the hostages. And I don't think there's an appetite for continuing, you know, what we've seen over the last 15 months. But Netanyahu's calculations are different. I think for him, continuing the war allows him to remain in power, and that has been his overriding priority.
Khaled, finally, sparing a thought for people in Gaza, you've done a lot of work on displacement, and 16 months of war caused displacement for Palestinians of historic magnitude. As a ceasefire deal was going through, we spoke on the show with a resident of Gaza who was skeptical that the fighting could really end. She didn't want to get her hopes up because it makes the displacement even harder. With that woman on our minds, I'd like to hear from you, Khaled, how this news impacts displaced people.
I think it's very distressing. People are just starting to clear rubble, to return to the areas of their homes, since in most cases the actual homes are destroyed, trying to establish some normalcy and not knowing whether that can continue or if they're going to be simply subjected to more bombing and displaced yet again is, I think, I'm sure, deeply unsettling for ordinary Palestinians in Gaza. There's no question.
There's also a historical context to displacement of Palestinians, right?
Yes, absolutely. And given the Palestinian history and the history of the conflict itself, I mean, the root cause of this conflict was the displacement of most of Palestine's Arab population in 1948 with Israel's creation. And that has what is sort of perpetuated this conflict for as long as it has. So the prospect that Palestinians would be yet again displaced, even permanently outside of what's left of their homeland, is not only unsettling and deeply traumatizing for millions of Palestinians, but will be extremely destabilizing for the region and very likely to perpetuate violence and instability for generations. And so it's not just wrong and immoral and illegal, it's also, I think, from a geopolitical standpoint, colossally stupid. And we've now added a new layer of generational trauma that will define Palestinian identity and Palestinian politics in ways that we can't even predict for many decades to come. You know, future generations of Palestinians that haven't even been born will look back at this moment as formative and as decisive in one form or another. There's no question about that.
Khaled El-Ghindi is a visiting scholar at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's been speaking with us about the fragile ceasefire deal in Gaza.
Earlier this week, a bomb went off in a quiet suburb of Moscow. The man killed in the explosion was the leader of a pro-Russian paramilitary group in eastern Ukraine, and he was a wanted man by Ukraine's government since 2014. These types of assassinations, plus drone strikes deep inside Russia, are part of a larger Ukrainian strategy aimed at bringing the fight to the Kremlin. The World's Daniel Hoffman explains.
The explosion happened in the lobby of a luxury apartment complex called Scarlet Sails, located in a well-to-do neighborhood in northwest Moscow. Early Monday morning, videos began appearing online showing the aftermath of the blast. When first responders arrived on the scene, glass and debris was scattered everywhere, and there was still smoke in the air. In a Deutsche Welle report, a local woman says, "I have three kids and I'm terrified." Russia's investigative committee has launched an investigation into what they called an assassination that was carefully planned. This kind of attack has happened before, most recently in December.
Breaking overnight, the leader of Russia's nuclear protection forces killed in a bombing in Moscow. Russian officials say the bomb was hidden inside an electric scooter and detonated remotely outside an apartment building today.
These operations are the latest in what seems to be a campaign of assassinations. Some of them are thought to be orchestrated by Ukraine's military intelligence agency known as HUR. In a 2022 interview with ABC, Kirilo Budanov, the director of HUR, was asked about these kinds of attacks deep inside Russia.
I can't give you answer right now on this question. Only after ending of this war.
After the war, you can answer that?
I think so.
What's your reaction to it, even if you don't claim responsibility?
I'm very glad to see this. Yeah. That's my reaction.
In most cases, Ukraine doesn't claim responsibility, but it doesn't deny its involvement either. Serhii Hrabsky, a retired Ukrainian colonel and military expert, says these attacks have a psychological impact.
It's destroyed confidence of Russian society that Moscow can provide protection to any of Russian region.
Hrabsky says targeted attacks also send a message to those who've participated in Russia's invasion of Ukraine. In most cases, according to Hrabsky and others, Ukrainian intelligence plans the operations but doesn't execute them.
We don't even need to send our boys there. We recruit locals in Russia to kill those guys, and we will do that by Russian hands.
Hrabsky says that most of the deep strikes that Ukraine conducts inside Russia aren't aimed at individuals. The main target is Russia's oil and gas infrastructure. In the past few weeks, Ukraine has hit multiple major oil refineries.
Fuel is like a blood of war because, you know, without fuel, you cannot deploy troops. You cannot deploy ammunition and supplies, water, food. You cannot provide medical evacuation and so on and so on.
Another military expert, Valery Romanenko, at the National Aviation University in Ukraine, says this campaign of hitting oil refineries and depots in Russia has been ongoing for about a year.
I am completely sure that all attacks were provided from Ukrainian territory using the Ukrainian long-range drones. Because now we have a large number of drones with a range up to 1,200 kilometers.
That's about 750 miles. Yuri Sak, an advisor to the Minister of Strategic Industries in Ukraine, says that Kyiv is developing longer-range deep-strike drones. On the front lines, Ukraine is slowly losing ground as Russian troops advance in the eastern part of the country. So Sak says the deep strikes impact the Kremlin's thinking, but also the perception of Ukraine by its partners.
They see that we are not just sitting idly and asking for military support. We are producing these capabilities ourselves. And by conducting these strikes, we give them an argument that Ukraine is still standing, that Ukraine is fighting back.
Sak says that Ukrainians want the war to end more than anyone else in the world. But he also talks about a just peace, which he believes can only be achieved if Ukraine shows strength. Otherwise, he says, Russia will not be deterred. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
An update now from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. As we've been reporting, rebels have been fighting government forces in eastern DRC, reportedly helped by neighboring Rwanda. The rebel group M23 took more ground today, even though it declared a ceasefire earlier in the week. M23 had already seized control of the city of Goma, home to 2 million people. The UN says the Red Cross has collected almost 2,000 bodies of people killed in the violence in Goma. Rebels are now advancing on the regional capital, Bukavu. We'll have more on that story tomorrow here on The World.
Just ahead, Thailand cuts off the electricity to scam centers in Myanmar. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thailand has cut electricity to parts of Myanmar just across the border. The move targets compounds where phone scams are operating. They are notorious for raking in huge amounts of money by texting and calling unsuspecting people all over the world. These scam centers got their electricity and internet from Thailand until today. The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok describes how they work.
Oh, they're really big. They're like small towns. You can actually see them from Thailand looking across the river into Myanmar. You'll see multi-story buildings. They're like office towers in the middle of the jungle. And they'll have a small army of people in there in call centers just pinging cell phone numbers 24/7, usually through messaging apps like WhatsApp. Often they use the avatar of an attractive woman because it's often male scammers posing as women to seduce men around the world to soften them up and urge them to put money into a too-good-to-be-true cryptocurrency investment, and then poof, their savings are gone. Now, that's the scammers. If you look at the bosses of these compounds, it's Chinese crime syndicates. Many of them find running scam compounds preferable to trafficking drugs.
And why was Thailand supplying electricity to these compounds in the first place if they were across the border in Myanmar?
Well, every compound paid for its electricity and internet service through shell companies registered in Thailand, and they got the power via electric cables strung over the river into Myanmar. It was actually very notoriously out in the open. These scamming syndicates were making, or are making, according to the UN, billions of dollars a year. So did some of that get siphoned off to keep Thai authorities happy? We don't know, but today Thai officials brought in local media into their electricity command center to prove that they really are truly killing the power to these compounds once and for all. That's a Thai official standing in front of a giant switchboard, and he's saying, "See here, the voltage is really down to 0 amps. We totally cut it." They're basically trying to dispel any notion that this power cut is just for show.
So clearly trying to project there to the public that they're turning off the electricity. Why is Thailand doing this now?
Because the Thai prime minister is currently visiting Beijing to meet Chinese leader Xi Jinping, and China's government hates these scam compounds. It makes them look bad because some of their homegrown criminals were the ones that set them up. And more than that, they don't like that these scam compounds have lured Chinese nationals to come under the promises of legit jobs. They will actually get locked in warehouses and forced to scam. This is a very common tactic, actually. Scammers pinging all of our phones are victims themselves, forced to rake in a bunch of money or else they get beaten. And it's actually very valuable to have Chinese speakers in the compounds because China is a huge economy, huge market, huge opportunity to scam people. So this got so out of hand that Chinese tourists started not coming to Thailand, fearing they'd be kidnapped into a scam center, and the Thai government had to act decisively.
So will this decisive action actually cause these compounds to close, or are they going to just figure out a workaround?
I don't think they're going to close. The money is just too good. I mean, remember, billions of dollars a year. This is almost on par with the drug trade. And there are workarounds. I've traveled extensively around the border zones in Myanmar where these scam compounds are. It's a rugged place where everybody is used to using generators, diesel generators. So that's an option. Internet access is harder, but all you need is 3G, 4G, which bleeds across the border, or Starlink, the satellite internet service owned by Elon Musk. There are workarounds, and the scamming is too lucrative to just let it go.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
President Trump's pledge to carry out mass deportations has alarmed schools and universities where deportation raids could be carried out. California has state laws that limit cooperation with federal immigration enforcement, but some lawmakers want more protection for the classroom. From KQED in San Francisco, Taiki Hendricks reports.
On a Saturday morning in Pittsburgh, California, a working-class city in the Bay Area, hundreds of families have come out to an immigration forum at a local elementary school.
In order for both police and ICE to enter your home, they have to have a judicial warrant.
There's a Know Your Rights workshop where a lawyer says if agents are at your door, you don't have to let them in unless they can show a warrant signed by a judge.
Okay?
I speak with Reina, the mother of a Pittsburgh high school student.
Alumnos no están llegando, muchos no están llegando.
She says since Trump took office, kids are staying home from school, afraid they could be arrested or their parents taken away while they're in class.
Tienen miedo de que mientras ellos están en clases vayan por sus papás a la casa.
Reina is a U.S. citizen, originally from Honduras. She came to the event with her sister Maria, who needs help with her asylum case. The women asked not to use their last names, since Maria's immigration status is uncertain. They speak to me while waiting for a free consultation with a lawyer. Maria says she's so nervous she sometimes can't eat or sleep, and she sees it affecting her 8-year-old son. He sees things changing, and he asks if we're going to get deported, she says. Under California's sanctuary law, schools, courts, and other public institutions won't voluntarily work with immigration agents. And the state has just rolled out guidance on how to put that in practice. Pittsburgh School Superintendent Janet Schultz, who helped organize this immigration clinic, is on it.
We already had a process in place for, you know, the unlikely event if immigration comes to any of our schools. So we are training our front office staff so that they are aware of what to do.
And the fear at schools has only increased since the Trump administration ended protections for, quote, sensitive areas. Last week on CBS News, correspondent Major Garrett asked the new Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, about that policy reversal.
So is it your operating assumption that some of these people you describe as the worst of the worst can be and will be found inside churches and hospitals and schools?
I'm saying that those are not going to be safe zones.
In this context, some California lawmakers don't think the state's existing laws are strong enough. Democratic Assemblymember Al Muratsuchi introduced one of three new bills aimed at keeping immigration agents away from schools.
Children should not feel threatened by going to school. They should feel safe by going to school, and parents should feel safe in dropping their kids off at school.
Public universities in California have long offered financial, legal, and other support to their undocumented students. Ju Hong runs the Dream Resource Center at UCLA.
So there's a lot of worries and uncertainty, and so they just want some policy updates and definitely legal support.
But so far, the University of California leadership has said little, declining our request for an interview and issuing a short statement that said they're monitoring how the new administration could impact the university. That's not enough for students at UC Berkeley. They marched on campus last week, demanding more support for immigrant students. Back at the elementary school in Pittsburgh, Maria, the asylum seeker from Honduras, says events like this forum are important, but not enough people are taking advantage of them. She says when she invited friends to join her, they said no. They were afraid the event could be a trap and immigration agents could round up everyone there. For The World, I'm Taiki Hendricks, Pittsburgh, California.
You're with The World.
The Aga Khan was a spiritual leader for one branch of Islam. He had a global vision.
He worked tirelessly throughout his life to make that a possibility, to make that a reality for humanity at large, and not just for the Ismaili community, for all human beings who reside on the planet Earth.
Still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Most of the gadgets we use every day rely on chips, electronic chips. But that's about to change. The chips of the future are chips of light. They use light particles known as photons to move data. Europe wants to lead the way in the technology. For a glimpse into the future, The World's Jerry Haddon takes us to the Spanish town of Castelldefels, the site of one of Europe's leading photonics laboratories.
Electronic microprocessors, or chips, the ones in your phone, your car, your TV, use electrons to move data.
So electrons are the elementary particles of currents, and we say photons are the elementary particles of light.
On a recent morning, Valerio Brunieri, chief researcher here at the Institute of Photonic Sciences, lays out the basics. There are big advantages to using photons and microchips, he says. First, they can carry a lot more information.
So light has a higher frequency, right? So it means that we can put more bits per second on a light wave.
And that wave can be split up into different colors, like a rainbow.
And each color corresponds to a different frequency. Now imagine, you can select each color within the rainbow, right? And modulate each color to transmit information.
This rainbow of info-laden photons is also fast. If electrons are tricycles powered by six-year-olds, photons are bullet trains. In Denmark, a couple of years ago, scientists using one single photonic chip were able to send 1.8 petabytes over an optical fiber cable. That's roughly double the total global internet traffic. Photons are also energy efficient, don't require cooling. The challenge, Brunieri says, is scaling up the technology, going from lab to fab, he says, or laboratory to fabrication. With the advent of AI, big tech companies are desperate for new energy sources. Currently, the carbon footprint of AI is huge.
You've heard in the U.S. they're even thinking of reopening the Three Mile Island nuclear installation to essentially supply a data center for AI, right?
Switching to photonic chips would, in theory, make bids for decommissioned nuclear power plants unnecessary. So there's a global race on to get these photonic chips to market. China and the U.S. are out front. The European Union, a leader in photonics research, is playing catch-up in production. To remedy that, it has just awarded a total of $400 million to this center and others to figure out how to scale up production to attract private companies.
Europe is caring a lot about sovereignty, so for sure, photonic chips, you know, as electronic chips are considered critical technology, so Europe wants to have their own, infrastructures.
Experts say Europe got a wake-up call during the COVID pandemic when suspended global supply chains caused a microprocessor shortage. Roberto Llorente is with the Nanophotonics Technology Center at Valencia's Polytechnical University.
A few years ago, we have seen that in the case of German car manufacturers, they had to stop the car production.
That was at Opel's plant in Eisenach in 2021.
Because they were missing microprocessors that are implemented in electronics.
Llorente says if that happens down the road with photonic chips, Europe will suffer setbacks, perhaps even greater ones, because photon technology is going to be found in lots of things. On a tour of the Photonics Institute, I meet Felicien Appa, who's using tiny crystals to capture and store single photons.
It can hold it for a few tens of microseconds, but we actually are in the process of pushing this towards more some milliseconds, which is still a fraction of a time that is meaningful to human beings, let's say.
This helps run experiments towards a long-term goal to build the quantum internet.
We will have nodes that can create this quantum light and store it, and then eventually we'll be able to share this information between all the nodes in a very secure way.
In other words, an unhackable internet, one that's not based on mathematical code that can be cracked. The quantum internet would be encrypted with light. If a hacker tries to even locate or measure the photon, it changes and sets off alarms. In another lab, researcher Chris Hill is using photons to isolate and study tiny bacteria that actually carry traces of iron oxide inside them. The iron helps the bacteria use the Earth's magnetic fields to move to areas of low oxygen, which they like.
One proposal is to use this bacteria for cancer research. A crazy idea is that if you put them in your body, they seek low oxygen, and so tumors are naturally low oxygen environments.
Once the bacteria reach those cancer cells, you could potentially blast them with oscillating magnetic fields, which would heat up that iron oxide they're carrying.
It would be like little kamikaze bacteria that find cancer cells.
Exactly.
Wriggle up to them and overheat them and kill them.
Exactly. That's exactly the idea.
This is all long-term stuff, but if it ever works, the news of it will likely reach us on an internet brought to you on a rainbow of photons. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon at the Institute of Photonic Sciences, Castelldefels, Spain.
Sweden is reeling after a mass shooting yesterday. It happened at an adult education center in the city of Örebro. 11 people were killed in what's being described as the worst mass shooting in Sweden's history. It follows a wave of violence there that has rattled the country. Ardavan Kochnud is an associate professor at Lund University, where he researches gun violence in Sweden. He says Swedes are still processing what happened on Wednesday.
They are, of course, quite shocked over what has happened. They are very saddened. There is a huge dark cloud over the Swedish society, and people are quite nervous over what the police investigation will show and how that will affect the society in the future. And with that, I mean, what kind of a motive the offender had when he conducted this attack. People are a little bit nervous over what the investigation will show.
Sweden, as I mentioned, has seen a number of violent incidents lately. Just last week, there was the killing of a man who was being sentenced for burning a Quran. There have been other incidences of gang violence in recent weeks as well. What is going on here?
So during the last decade, or the last two decades at least, Sweden has had major issues with gang violence and criminal networks. And this has contributed to Sweden having major issues with firearm-related violence, as well as explosive violence.
And by explosive violence, you mean bombs, grenades, things like that?
Exactly. Hand grenades, homemade bombs, mostly, precisely. And except that we had also the homicide of Salva Momica, the man who had burned the Quran. We don't know still how he was killed. We know that he was shot to death, but we don't know who did it. And if it was because he had burned the Quran, then this would no longer be a case of regular homicide, but this would be a terrorist attack. And then yesterday we had this school attack in Örebro here in Sweden. So Sweden, we have a quite serious situation going on currently.
So how have authorities been responding to this uptick in violence in Sweden?
So both the previous government in Sweden, which was a left-wing government, and the current government in Sweden, which is a right-wing government, have done quite a lot to curb the gang violence and the gang criminality in Sweden. We have had a lot of new laws coming in, and they have been effective because last year we had the lowest rate of shootings in Sweden during the couple of years we have had. However, this is not enough. We still see criminal gangs and networks being quite able and quite effective in using violence. And one major problem we are witnessing in Sweden today is that many of the offenders are children or very young individuals, where Sweden has very strong laws to protect them, which makes it very difficult for the police to work.
Is what happened yesterday impacting how safe you feel on the streets in Sweden right now?
I think that the majority of the individuals living in Sweden feel quite safe on the streets. However, both the government as well as governmental agencies like the police have over and over stated that when you are out of your house, when you're out on the streets, be aware of your surroundings. If you hear any shootings, if you hear an explosion, try to hide. Because we have had several incidents during the past years where fully innocent individuals, not having anything to do with criminal gangs and criminal networks, have either been killed or been severely injured because they have been in a, well, wrong place at a wrong time.
Ardavan Koshnut is an associate professor at Lund University who researches gun violence in Sweden. He joined us from the city of Malmö.
Syria's interim president has been traveling around the region, presenting his country in a new light. In Syria, people are celebrating the start of a new chapter, but the extent of the atrocities committed by former President Bashar al-Assad and his government are also becoming more clear, and the families of victims want justice and accountability. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
In the days following the fall of Bashar al-Assad, Wafa Mustafa returned to her homeland for the first time in years. She was filmed in Damascus among a sea of people, each holding photos of their loved ones who'd gone missing.
We gathered today to talk about our loved ones, to for the first time say who they were, who they are, what did they do when they were arrested, and to say that we will accept nothing less than the full truth of what happened to them.
Mustafa's father, Ali Mustafa, was taken from his home by security forces in 2013. He was never heard from again. In the years since, Mustafa and her family have done everything in their power to look for any trace of him. The fall of Assad has brought about a new Syria, one in which Syrians are free to openly discuss the crimes of past officials and envision a road to justice and accountability. It's a day Muhammad al-Abdullah has dreamt of for years.
I was imprisoned in 2005 for a short period, but then again in 2006, and I landed in Sadnaya military prison, and I met my father there.
Al-Abdullah is a human rights activist. He started his work before the civil war in 2011. His father was a writer, also critical of the Assad regime.
I didn't know he was there. And after 2 months, we came across each other in the state security court. And he told me he's in Sadnaya. And I told him I'm in Sadnaya too.
The judge agreed to place the father and son together in the notorious Sadnaya prison. Al-Abdullah and his father were eventually released. They were lucky. Many Syrians who ended up in Sadnaya never made it out. Since his release, Al-Abdullah has worked with a team of other human rights activists to collect evidence of Assad's crimes.
We've been sitting on 500,000 pages of intelligence records, cables, and 2 million videos from YouTube.
The Syria Justice and Accountability Center, which Al-Abdullah heads, has been connecting the crimes to Syrian officials. They've been doing this work from outside Syria, and it's not been easy. Their contacts on the ground faced constant threats and intimidation, he says. They had to wait years before their sources could leave the country.
People are joking now, we're comparing photos of team members, like how much gray hair everybody got.
The information they collected is going to be critical in what happens next in Syria.
It's always what's amazing in this, in these types of states and regimes, is this whole bureaucracy of evil.
Nemar Jalacik is with the Commission for International Justice and Accountability, which has been gathering evidence against Syrian officials for years. She says what has helped investigators is that everything was meticulously recorded. There are lists of prisoners, where they were held, and who interrogated them. What they show, she adds, is that the crimes were approved at the highest level.
What we are facing now is that all of a sudden, the totality of the archives have become available.
The challenge is to safeguard them, she says. In the past few years, over 20 cases have been prosecuted in European courts. Jalacik and others say now that Assad is gone, trials should take place inside Syria and be led by Syrians.
What now needs to happen in this dialogue period, in the planning period, etc., is the design of what accountability looks like for Syria.
This is not going to be easy. There have already been reports of revenge attacks against those considered to have been regime loyalists. Back in December, this video emerged online showing a group of men executing two people who they say were connected to the former government. They call them pigs as they shoot at them. The men lie on the ground, their hands tied behind their backs. It's not clear how widespread these attacks are, but Muhammad al-Abdullah, who spent time in prison with his father, disagrees with this kind of vigilante justice.
I want a fair trial for Bashar al-Assad. I don't want him to see or face the things we faced before his courts, because that's the way forward to build a real nation.
The former president has sought refuge in Russia. Putin is a close ally. But Nemar Jalacik says that doesn't mean he has escaped justice.
You know, it wouldn't be the first time that you have a dictator thinking he got away with it and sought refuge in the allied country, and then things change and then they are handed over.
It won't happen overnight, she says. It will take time and a lot of patience. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
And now the story of an epic journey to save a tiny creature. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
While the human world is dealing with the effects of COVID, the frog world is dealing with its own global pandemic, chytrid fungus. Ben Tapley is the amphibian curator at the London Zoo.
The chytrid fungi have caused the decline of over 500 different species of amphibians and the extinction of at least 90, probably more.
This disease has been devastating to a species known as the Darwin's frog, which has an unusual way of breeding. The male frog swallows the fertilized eggs and incubates them in his vocal sac.
And the tadpoles will get their kind of develop their legs in there, the tails will be absorbed, and then he'll spit out fully formed froglets, which are about 5 millimeters long, so about the size of a grain of rice.
In 2023, scientists found chytrid fungus in Tantalco Park in a remote part of Chile. It was supposed to be a sanctuary for the Darwin's frog. Within a year, 90% of the population was wiped out. NGOs in Chile and Europe teamed up for a rescue mission. Over 5 days in October, researchers spread out in the dense rainforest trying to track down frogs the size of a thumbnail. A camera crew from the Zoological Society of London went with them. That's actually not a frog. It's a person. He's making frog calls in his throat in the hopes an actual frog answers him and gives away its hiding place.
I vocalize like the frog, like to do a playback with the frog. Yeah, sometimes they respond me.
The team collected 55 frogs and brought them back to a specially built facility at the London Zoo. And as it turns out,
11 of the males that were captured were actually pregnant. And so we could actually see the tadpoles writhing around in their vocal sac. And also recently we've had the first eggs that have been laid as well, which is incredible. So the first kind of true captive breeding.
Conservationists hope to breed the frogs and study potential treatments for chytrid fungus that would allow the Darwin's frogs to return home. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. He was the spiritual leader of a branch of Islam with influence across the globe. His Highness Prince Karim al-Husseini died on Tuesday at the age of 88. His title was the 49th Aga Khan. Today, his son, Prince Rahim al-Husseini, was announced as the new Aga Khan following the reading of his father's will. The late Aga Khan helped build homes, hospitals, and schools through his charity network. He was also dedicated to the restoration of Islamic architecture throughout the Muslim world. Daryush Mohammadpour is an associate professor at the Institute of Ismaili Studies in London.
I think the most important legacy of His Highness the Aga Khan, Shah Karim al-Husseini, was that he was a voice of reason, of the faith of Islam, which is compatible with the world in which you're living. And the most important element of the interpretation of Islam, or the kind of Islam, the kind of Shi'i Islam in particular that he was representing, was that it belonged to humanity and it was in the service of humanity, as we could see it in the most important key motto of the Arkan Development Network and the Ismaili Imamate, that the role of the Ismaili Imam is to improve the quality of life of people, of his community and the people amongst whom they live. And there is a very humanistic element at the very heart of it.
So the late Aga Khan was dedicated to his philanthropic work throughout the globe. What do you think drove him towards that? I mean, you were just talking about many things that I think maybe probably kind of come into the question.
He made this point that unfortunately the Western world does not have a good understanding of what the Ismaili Imamate does. So they look at his work as philanthropy. And he just simply explains that the reason I do these things is not because I'm a philanthropist. It is because I am an imam of a Shi'i Muslim community. And it emanates from the very nature of the office of imamate that I need to be concerned about the material, about the worldly aspects of the lives of human beings. And if you call that philanthropy, be my guest. But all the things that the Aga Khan does in his network, in his institutions, in the areas of education, healthcare, media, architecture, the environment, they are all closely connected with the way that he understands faith and the faith of Islam. They are inseparable from one another.
The Aga Khan was also very passionate about Islamic architecture, historical Islamic architecture. Can you tell us about different projects he managed to help redevelop?
So the key idea about architecture is that the Ismaili Imam looked at architecture as one of the most powerful vehicles to promote pluralism, to promote cultural understanding, and you could see it in various ways that different human communities have been engaging with. He's also been deeply engaged with restoration projects all around the developing world. If you go to Afghanistan, if you go to Pakistan, if you go to Syria, if you go to India, if you go to Iran, you would see that the Ismaili Imamate has been closely engaged with the restoration of these historical sites because he believes that this is one of the most powerful vehicles to communicate what he considers to be the humanistic message of being a Muslim.
Daryush, the presence of the Aga Khan seems to have been around my entire life, even though I never knew what he looked like or where in the world he was. But the fact that we knew of him and his philanthropic work somehow speaks to the bridges he was able to create to the West.
When you talk about a religious leader, immediately the image that comes into the mind of a European person of a Muslim leader or of a Shi'i leader is somebody who's wearing a turban, somebody who's got a long beard, somebody who is separated from the material world and has got nothing to do with this physical world, and they're leading a very pious ascetic way of life. And of course, it took generations to actually change that perception. And the way that the Ismaili Imamate went about doing it was not just in terms of preaching it or just saying that, okay, we are different. What he did is that he started building institutions in these different areas, and these institutions have got a longevity attached to them, not just in institutions in terms of the organizations, but also institutions in terms of the buildings that represent that kind of vision that is inclusive, that is pluralistic, that is open to others, that has got a sense of hospitality to them, of being open to the other person who, regardless of their creed or their gender or their color or any kind of index of difference that you could find in their life. So that is the bridge that he was trying to gap.
Let me just pick up on part of what you were saying there, Dariush. Islam has been the focus, as you know, of much debate in recent years in the West. Like, what does it mean when forces like ISIS and Al-Qaeda claim to have the proper interpretation of Islam? How did the Aga Khan deal with those beliefs?
Of course, the Imam's response was that it is wrong, it's factually incorrect to refer to Islam just with the representation of, I don't know, a Wahhabi Salafi version of Islam or a Twelver Isnashari version, the way that the Iranian regime is representing it today, or to reduce it to some Sufi sect. There are all kinds of diversities among Muslims, but also he takes into account that the kind of reactions that you see in Muslim communities, even when it comes to the case of fundamentalism, he looks at them with a very compassionate, with a very understanding way of discussing these issues rather than just stigmatizing them or just turning them down or just demonizing them. Because for him, if a particular community in a part of the world is reacting with violence, you've got to look at the sources and the causes and the roots of that violence. And many parts of the world, including the Middle East, that people just forget that there is originally some problem occurred at the previous time, which has led to all the tragic consequences that we see today. And in this sense, the Ismaili Imamate, who does not condone violence at all, who does not see Islam in that way, also at the same time recognizes and acknowledges the complex nature of the way different human societies engage with their faith. And he often used to give the example of the IRA.
The Irish Republican Army, yeah.
Says, can you ever come back to Europe and say that the Catholic Church is about what the IRA does? Nobody would buy that. Everybody would laugh at that. But people are very comfortable with just equating the entire Muslim community and its history with the ISIS or with Iran or with Hamas or with this or that political group without seeing the context and the dynamic nature of all these events.
When you look back at all that the Aga Khan managed to accomplish in his time as leader of the Ismaili community, what do you think his legacy is going to be?
Actually, he said this on the occasion of his 50th anniversary of his imamate. He said that when I became the imam, I didn't have these institutions. I have created these institutions so that the next generation of imamate, when they are in place, they have the wherewithal, they have the vehicles, they have the means at their disposal to do their job and to care for humanity in a much easier way so that they do not have to build from scratch.
Dariush Mohammadpour is an associate professor at the Institute of Ismaili Studies. He joined us from London.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Mary Elizabeth Alexander, Sarah and Stephen Bass, Stephanie Fox and Drew Britcher, Deet and Paul Meserve, and Corey Zanin. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.